You're listening to the Corner House podcast, available from www.cornerhouse.org.
Hola! Welcome to another jam-packed edition of your favourite podcast with me, Sarah Perks, Programme and Engagement Director here at Corner House. We've got a bit of a Spanish theme on this week with the release of Julia's Eyes. However, the weather at the moment is not particularly Spanish, not particularly sunny. That aside, the weather's perfect for spending far too much time in your favourite art centre. This week, we've got a very special guest joining us. I'm delighted to introduce top British artist, one of my favourite artists, Jamie Shovlin, whose practice mixes advanced technical skills across a range of media with conceptual ideas. For me, these are often around the notion of an archive or how we construct memory. Examples include Naomi V. Jellish, which was famously, sorry, notoriously, bought by Charles Saatchi. Also a project called Les Faust, and also a new project called Hike and Meet, which is about 70s, 80s exploitation horror films. But we'll find out more about those later. And also, Dr. Andrew Willis is back from his holidays, so we'll be going straight on with some Spanish horror chat. Of course, we'll have our regular mini What's On guide, and one of the Corner House team will kindly give us their recommendation of the week. So let's start things off with our film focus. A few weeks ago, you remember we did talk a little bit about Uruguayan horror, a little bit about South American horror, but now we're going to a bit more, should we say, old school Spanish horror, so horror films from mainland Spain. This week it's called Julia's Eyes. Now, Andy, for those who haven't seen as much Spanish horror as you, tell us what defines it as a genre, give us a little history of Spanish horror.
Well, it's probably not enough time to give you a sort of full-blown history, because there's some examples of sort of fantastic horror-type cinema in the early part of the 20th century made in Spain, in Barcelona. So it's been around for a long time. It's not particularly famous for horror up until, I would say, probably the early 1960s, when Jess Franco made his film The Awful Dr. Orloff, which kind of was a gothic horror in a sort of grand tradition. And really, the late 1960s saw Spanish horror really kick off. But really, I think Julia's Eyes is part of a much more recent phenomenon in Spanish horror. I think around about the sort of turn of the century, there was a move within Spain to kind of resurrect the horror genre, and there was a much greater emphasis on horror production than I think there had been probably for about 15, 20 years before. So Julia's Eyes is a very serious horror film, and I think the film that kickstarts that kind of tradition is Jaume Balagueró's film Lo Sin Nombre, The Nameless, which was on at Viva, which was made in 1999. Balagueró came over. It's adapted from a Ramsey Campbell novel. Ramsey was here. We had a great event that year. And that really started this serious horror trend. So you've got, as I say, Lo Sin Nombre in 1999. Jaume Balagueró went on and made a film called Darkness in 2002, Fragile in 2005, which people may be less familiar with, but I'm sure that most people who are interested in European horror and even horror generally have seen Wreck, which is his 2007 film. So he's kind of on that serious side. Alongside him, I would say the other film that kind of kick-started this serious trend in horror in Spain was Alejandro Amenábar's The Others, 2001. And that's an interesting film, I think, because it was shot in English. It's produced by Tom Cruise's production company. And I think it shows the way that a lot of these Spanish horror films are outward-looking. They're looking for international markets. Horror is a very bankable genre. It's easy to make a kind of medium budget film and make your money back quite successfully if you can market it all over the world. And I think with many, many countries speaking Spanish, a lot of these Spanish producers look globally to make their money back. So one of the key companies, Filmax, which is based in Barcelona, one of the interesting things about all of these serious types of horror coming out of Spain is many of the people come from Barcelona or Catalonia. Filmax is based there, Balagueró's from there. The guy who made Julia's Eyes, he's also from Barcelona. So it's a real Catalan horror film industry, really. So the other thing I think that's worth noting is, whilst all of that's really recent, there's a kind of interesting figure, almost a spectre, over this sort of horror trend in Spain. And that's the guy, people may have heard the best film, Goya, this year was awarded to a film called Black Bread, directed by a Mallorcan film director called Agustí Villaronga. And he, in a sense, is the godfather of these serious horror films. In 1987, he made a film called In a Glass Cage, which is a really quite horrific, sort of horror-tinged, Nazi-themed film. Then he made another film called 99.9. And then people may remember from Viva a few years ago, a film called Aro Tubulkin, In the Mind of a Killer. And he's kind of, in a sense, flown the banner or flown the flag for that kind of serious horror film. And I think Julia's Eyes is very much in that type of tradition. It's not a kind of throwaway, jokey, teen horror film. It's a film that wants to be seen as a serious horror film, as lots of this kind of recent tradition in Spanish horror do.
Okay, thank you, Andy. Jamie, so have you seen many of the films that Andy just mentioned?
I know a lot of the Franco films from the 60s and 70s. And I kind of lost a contact with, I guess, the notion of Spanish horror filmmaking until fairly recently with things like Rec. But I think one of the films I watched quite recently, which seems to kind of, I guess, echo with what Andy was saying, is The Cannibal Man, which is, I think, an Eloy de Iglesias film from the early 70s, which is notorious because it became a video nasty over here, partly because of the title. There's no cannibalism in that film at all. But it's actually, it's quite a psychological or a psychology-based study of a guy who goes insane and begins to murder people. But it has that kind of particularly Spanish feel to it that, you know, maybe is, you could, you know, point to Spain as, you know, being the only place that really has that kind of, that quality to it, which, having watched Julia's Eyes, there's some connection with that, I think.
Okay, so I've got a couple of well-informed guests with me. So let's find out what you both think about the film. Jamie, let's start with you. Did you like the film?
I thought it looked good. It was very well made, but it was very slow and almost ponderous, maybe better than slow. And it kind of, I think maybe it was a bit too mature for its own good. Almost calling it a horror film is maybe a, you know, bit of a misnaming of the genre it belongs to. It's more of a kind of thriller that I think as the film goes on, there are kind of more horrific elements introduced, but it kind of deals with like kind of old school style. Mm.
But it still makes
thrills.
You jump a little bit.
Exactly,
I did get a little bit stressed at times. A few shots that made me like, whoa.
That's what it does. That's what it sets out to do, and that's what it does successfully in, you know, a few scenes. One of the things that kind of annoyed me about it, and this annoys me about a lot of horror films, is that kind of bluish tinge that horror films have, like mature horror films have nowadays. Like, this is a serious film, which is something that I think probably been around for a lot longer, but it always seems to come from that kind of post-Ring era of horror films, especially when
when you think of the others, sort of your Pan's Labyrinth type stuff, that all has that blue, the Orphanage,
That kind of, just to remind you, you're constantly watching a horror film. To be fair to Julia's Eyes, actually, the cinematography is pretty good. You know, it deals very well with kind of like dark areas of the screen, and using those for kind of dramatic effect.
Okay, and Andy, what did you think?
Yeah, I quite liked it. I mean, one of the things, picking up on what Jamie just said, one of the things I thought was quite interesting about the film was how it often constrained the viewer's point of view. Mm-hmm. So for lots of sequences, you were not shown characters' faces. And I think that, because it was quite different from the way films are usually cut, created a sense of unease for me when I was watching it, because you're always kind of thinking, well, I want to see this person's face because it's through the face that you see the reaction or you learn how to interpret somebody's ideas or their intent or whatever it might be. So often it was quite, I found that quite tension-inducing in a way, because I was never sure how to quite read some of the characters. I won't say too much because I don't want to spoil some of the key scenes, but I think when people watch it, they'll probably get what I mean. But I would agree that, I mean, I don't know what it is. It's got to be something with film stock or something, that so many films are coming out with this kind of turquoisey, greeny blue. Because Black Bread, which I mentioned earlier, has also got exactly the same kind of colour tint to it. I think the other thing with this film is, if you're someone who has some familiarity with Spanish actors, as soon as you see the two leads, Belén Rudén and Luis Homar, then you kind of know it's going to be quite serious, because people probably will recognise Luis Homar from Broken Embraces, the Pedro Almodóvar film, and Belén Rudén from The Orphanage. So they're actors who come with a kind of serious actorly credentials. They're not kind of teens who you think are going to get killed at any time because you've no idea who they are. So I think this film wears its seriousness on its sleeves straight away, as has been said, with its visual style, its high production values, but also I think key in terms of that is its casting as well.
Yeah, I agree. One of the plus points for me is the central character, the female character. She is really strong, puts in a really fine performance. And Jamie, does she remind you of any characters in other, any women characters in other horror films?
I think it's been used a few times before, and the first thing I thought of was, not a direct equivalent, but Lauren Bacall in, I think it's in Someone's Watching Me, or The Eyes of Laura Mars, I always get those two confused, of somebody who is your kind of leading light in terms of narrative development, but is, you know, her kind of sense of seeing the world is kind of compromised. So you in that kind of surrogate role of actually experiencing things, this idea that stuff is kept away from you because it's kept away from the character. And I guess the one thing that some horror films does that this doesn't is that idea that you as a viewer know more than the characters.
Yeah.
Whereas in this, you're sharing that kind of lack of visibility with the central character. So I think it's one of those kind of well-exercised kind of devices whereby, you know, things unfold at the same time as they do to the characters.
Yeah. And did it have elements of exploitation, or is it really just a straight horror film?
I think it's kind of a handsome horror film. I wouldn't really associate this with exploitation. It's maybe what you make exploitation to get to at the end of your career. It's an adult film.
Yeah, I mean, we were saying before, it's a bit of a shame, in fact, that it's not a bit grubbier. It's almost too polished. And for me, it's slightly over-scripted, but it still is I really enjoyed the experience of watching it. It did get me on the edge of my seat at times. So it's a really competent, confident horror film that I think has got quite crossover audience as well. So not just people who enjoy foreign language films. I think it's, you kind of really forget about the subtitles and get immersed in the visuals and the tension. So quickly, Andy, who do you think will like the film?
Well, I think you've summed it up there. I think people who like the horror genre and like the horror genre taken seriously, they will like it. But also, as I was saying before, with the actors, with the Spanish connection, I think, you know, it would have settled quite nicely into the Viva programme, and I think it would have done well at Viva. So I think, you know, the Spanish or the audience for Spanish cinema, particularly those people who like something that maybe is not quite the Spanish cinema we're used to seeing in this country, kind of Civil War dramas or whatever that might be. You know, this shows you another side of the horror genre, it shows you another side of Spanish cinema. So I think people who are looking for maybe something that's a bit different from the conventional in terms of horror or in terms of Spanish cinema, I think they might enjoy what it offers.
Julia's Eyes starts screening from tomorrow, Friday the 20th of May, for at least 2 weeks. Check our website for all the times. Now, don't go anywhere because it's the quickfire round, our quickfire challenge. Don't forget, you can send in your thoughts as well by Twitter or conventional email. First off, you can guess what I'm going to ask. Best Spanish horror film, Jamie.
Thinking about it, it's not a horror film strictly, but there's a film called Vacas, which is made by Julia Medem from the 80s, which is not a horror film strictly, but it's a Spanish Civil War film, which has horrific elements to it and is kind of, since we're talking about eyes, is kind of, by the title, which is Spanish for cows, it's kind of seen from the eyes of animals. And that, I think, is a fantastic film.
Mm, yeah, it's a good film. I've seen it. Andy, yours?
Who Could Kill a Child? A Narciso Ibáñez Serrador film, which we showed at Viva a few years ago, which is just a crazy film with a whole island full of children rising up and killing all the adults because the adults are just too nasty.
Okay, and I'm going to have Thesis, which is an early Alejandro Amenábar film. It stars Eduardo Noriega, and I've forgotten the female actress, Andy. Oh, yeah, Anna Torrent. Maybe a bit more of a thriller, but there's horror elements, and it's all about her doing a thesis on, is it serial killers?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, next one. Best use of weird eyes, loss of sight in a horror film, or something that's, you could say, is the cornea transplant genre. Andy.
Seeing as Jamie mentioned Jess Franco earlier, I'd go for Jess Franco's Faceless, which has an absolutely top exploitation moment of someone having their eye injected with a syringe, and they use a side-on shot so you can see the needle going straight into the eye. What makes it all the more weird is it's the great French actress Stephanie Audran, who's in all the Claude Chabrol films, and you're horrified by what you're seeing, and you're also horrified by the fact that her career has tumbled so low that she's in a Jess Franco film.
Okay, Jamie.
I'm going to have to go with a film which I don't think is very good, but is fun. It's called The Headless Eyes, which is an early 70s American exploitation film where the main protagonist is an artist who has his eyes gouged out and replaced and subsequently goes on a killing spree where he gouges out eyes continually. I think the film exists as an excuse just to have a series of prolonged assaults on eyes.
The eye gouging genre, that
exactly.
one. And I'm going to have a Pang Brothers film. So they're from Thailand, but they made this in Hong Kong. Correct me if I'm wrong, Andy. It's called The Eye, and it was, I think, remade in Hollywood as well. About a violinist who has a cornea transplant and then starts to see. Okay, third one in our quickfire round. Starting with Jamie, what's your best 70s, 80s foreign language or foreign made exploitation film?
It's not my best, but it's the one I'd like most people to see. It's a Swedish film called The Sinful Dwarf. And it's a curious film. It's a very curious film, and it's one of those first exploitation films that actually has pornographic inserts to make it a hardcore film, but they're so out of context that it comes across as the most ridiculous thing ever.
I'm intrigued. Andy?
Well, as someone who, with the old Video Nasties thing, who was down at the local corner shop and the local garage getting those whopping great big boxes, I'll go for the sort of daddy of all Italian exploitation films, which would be Cannibal Holocaust. The film that started a million and one moral panics. And actually, when you watch it, there is quite a lot to actually be panicking about, particularly when they crack open the big turtle and start eating the insides.
Okay, thank you. I'm just going to chicken out this one because, like, I was obviously watching much more highbrow fare as a child. So thank you, and we'll be hearing a bit more from Jamie later on.
Art, film, books, food, drink. All at Corner House, Manchester.
Now it's time for our mini guide to what's on at Corner House and beyond. Now, I know absolutely nothing about Formula One, but I can tell you I'm looking forward to Asif Kapadia's Senna. And even better, Asif and his writer Manish Pandey are coming here for a special preview and Q&A on Tuesday the 31st of May at 6:10. And I'm pretty sure we tried to get Asif here for The Warrior and Far North, but he couldn't come. So I'm really glad that now he's come in and you get the chance to come, ask him some questions and get into detail about the film Senna, which is a documentary about Ayrton Senna. Last week, I went to the latest Chinese Art Centre opening and was really impressed by Angie Atmajaja's atmospheric sound-based installation, Intrinsic. So do go now until the 11th of June, and then it's going to be replaced by another of Angie's installations for the second half of the exhibition. They're really beautiful, like sound and light installations, great use of space in the Chinese Art Centre, so I recommend you check those out. Now, we've heard quite a few of you have sent in your request for the documentary about Irish dancing. It's called Jig. And we've put it on for selected screenings from Friday the 20th of May. So you must catch it this week. It's only going to be on a few times, so do catch it. Andy, you've seen it. Tell us a quick little bit about it.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of tells a story from different people around the world who are leading up to the World Irish Dancing Championships in Glasgow. And as with all documentaries, rather like Spellbound, it kind of follows these individuals as they lead up to the big event. It's a really interesting exploration of something I knew nothing about. It's one of those great moments when you're in the cinema and you think, this is a kind of subculture, a world people are absolutely dedicated to, and I had no idea it was going on. So obviously people will be into it and want to come and see it, but anybody else who just thinks that Irish dancing is Michael Flatley and Riverdance in 3D or whatever his film was at St. Patrick's Day, this shows you that it's much, much more than that. And by God, I don't know where they get the curly wigs from, but there's many, many, many of them in the film.
And by God, a subject that Andy doesn't know something about, does it really exist? Okay, finally, if you haven't already seen our exhibition, New Cartographers, do pop upstairs to our galleries. There's just a couple of weeks left. There's 10 artists over three floors, and we've also got something special with QR codes. So take your smartphone, scan the QR codes in the gallery, and you'll find out extra information.
Art, film, books, food, drink. All at Corner House, Manchester.
So, Jamie Shovlin's our special guest this week, so I'm going to take the opportunity to ask him a little bit about his artistic practice. So, Jamie, if someone isn't familiar with your work, I'm sure there's just a few listeners, please tell us what it is.
This is always the most difficult question, because I tend to work in a kind of project-based way, and each of those projects changes according to what the subject, the interest, the approach is. I think, generally, I'm kind of interested in how information passes between people, between institutions and people, and how that kind of information is made difficult, is compromised, is challenged by the various ways in which it's translated presentationally, content-wise, and so on. And I'm interested in using that as a means by which to kind of go back, revisit histories that have maybe been forgotten or the histories that have been maligned, and kind of, I guess, re-evaluate certain histories within my work by creating a kind of new way of looking at those histories.
Tell us about one of your projects, Lustfaust.
Lustfaust was an archive, an apparent truthful archive of a German band from the 70s, which actually was a false archive. It was initially presented as authentic, the idea being that it kind of was a way of structurally evaluating a historical period that was kind of celebrated but not really kind of critiqued. So within the archive, Lustfaust became the first band that ever used... This was a project that was begun in about 2003 when MySpace was very popular for distributing music. So this was a band that was kind of in our archive positioned as one of the originators of tape trading in the 70s, which there is quite a deep history of, but it hasn't ever really been isolated and kind of talked about. So there was a space there for Lustfaust to be positioned as a band in Berlin in 1976, which was obviously a very kind of notorious period for Berlin in the music scene. And they could be kind of related as the originators of this tape trading network. What was really the interest was this idea of a band as a kind of repository of different people's perception of what they are. So within the kind of remit of them being this originators of tape trading so that they'd release music for free, if you gave them a blank tape, there was an invitation when you'd send them your blank tape through the mail, they'd put the music on the tape and they'd send it back to you. Within that, there was an opportunity to create this visual archive, which would be different people's comprehension of the music, comprehension of the band, comprehension of themselves in their choice of cover art for those cassettes, which they were invited to complete by the band. So it was kind of using it as a means by which to look at a historical period that there's a lot written about, but there were certain things that were ignored, and simultaneously to get this idea of a notion of kind of identity or a band's identity that was kind of fluid and not fixed in the way, I guess.
Your projects are quite in-depth, really. It's not kind of gimmicky hoax or anything like that. It's actually quite in-depth and about kind of creating things, whether it is a sort of archive or a much wider project. What are you working on now?
I'm currently working on a long-term project, which you mentioned previously, Heike Meet, which is actually an extension from the Lustfaust project. Heike Meet is apparently a 1982, I think. God, I kind of remember my own false histories now. It's an exploitation film made by the Imagine director, Jesus Rinzoli. And it's also the name of a concept album by Lustfaust, which is their seventh album, which is the soundtrack to this film, Heike Meet. Heike Meet obviously doesn't exist in the given form. It's not an exploitation film of 1982. It's kind of a working process whereby I'm working with several other people to generate material relating to a film that doesn't exist. So the idea is that the film itself exists primarily to function and allow other people to contribute to it. So to create a mythology of the film without the film actually ever existing or being visible. So things like posters, soundtrack, score, script, and dialogue, they're all generated, but the film remains invisible. So it's kind of weaving this mythology of, first of all, creating the identity for a film, and then secondarily creating a history for the film to exist within, whereby you have a reflection of the fact that a film might be made by a director for a certain reason, but as soon as it goes into the world of distribution, it becomes something that might be entirely separate from that. So Heike Meet itself is a seventh or eighth generation re-edit of what was originally an Italian film called La Raccolta dei Fiori Salvatici, which is The Harvest of the Wildflowers. So I'm kind of midway through that project. That's probably going to go on for another 2 or 3 years, I think.
Yeah, it's a really interesting way of working and a project that we're kind of involved with, and we'll see Jamie come back over the next few years and you'll definitely hear more from him. Just before I let you go, which artists do you think are interesting at the moment that people should check out?
What a question. Somebody I'm really looking at a lot in a minute with similar kind of approach to this project, but somebody who does entirely differently is Johan Grimmen-Perez. He's a Belgian. Yeah, you probably call him a filmmaker, but he trained as an anthropologist and he makes films from other films, but in a kind of much more deconstructivist and critical, culturally critical way. There's two of his films that I saw last year at the Fruit Market in Edinburgh, which was Dial History and I can't remember the name of it, but it's a film about Hitchcock and his doubles. And they're both feature length, but are incredibly engrossing and really articulate and really great films. And I'd recommend anyone see those if they can get hold of them.
Yeah, definitely. We showed the Hitchcock film here, but I've forgotten what it's called,
Double
Andy.
Take.
Oh, Double Take, that's it. Yep, yep. Great film, highly recommend it. Okay, well, thank you, Jamie, for joining us for the whole podcast as well, not just a part of the interview. And also thank you, Andy, for being our regular contributor. Okay, it's time for a quick recommendation of the week. It's by, again, Isabel Croissant, our Creative Industries producer, and she's going to tell us about Thinking Digital.
So next week, I would urge you to come to our annex to have a look at the live cast of the Thinking Digital conference. So Thinking Digital is a conference that takes place in Gateshead, and it's got an amazing range of speakers. For those of you who are a bit scared about technology, it's not about technology as in for geek with a lot of code and you won't understand anything. It's more kind of interesting things that are going to happen or that are happening for like people who have grown up in the digital era, so mainly most of us, really. It's kind of was inspired by the TED Talks, if you're familiar with them, and it's just interesting things. So here are a few highlights of like some of the people who are talking at the conference and that will be broadcast to the Annex. On the first day, on the Wednesday, there's a guy called Paul Rowling, and he's the founder of a company called ScreenReach Interactive. Now, I'm not even going to try to explain to you what they do, because they will, but they're from the north of England, and they're considered one of the most exciting startups in the UK, and they got the prize for the best startup in the Super Tech Festival that's South by Southwest in Texas, so one to look for. One of the other speakers on Wednesday is Stephen Babbage, who's the Director of Applied Science at Microsoft. Now, that doesn't tell you anything, does it? But basically, he does loads of things about interface technology. So I don't know if you remember, if you've seen this crazy table that you can interact with by touching, you know, putting your credit card in and it pays for things, etc. Well, that was part of one of his project, and he's going to talk about the future of interactive display, how they can be completely immersive. So that's going to be quite interesting. On a completely different subject, there's Patrick Meyer, who's the director of a company that uses online mapping and crowdsourcing to direct resource and attention to places that need help. So, for instance, they've done loads of stuff with Haiti for like practical help to help people, but also with places where there was political unrest, so to kind of gather news, etc. There's also Nancy Duarte, who's a presentation specialist. That sounds a bit nerdy, doesn't it? Well, she's the one who did the whole presentation that was the basis for an Inconvenient Truth for Al Gore. So I think you'll see pretty cool things there. And finally, just to finish the day, there's a robot that will come. Data the robot will come with Heather Knight, who's a researcher in robotics. And that will be the end of the first day. But I think you might want to come back for the second day. The second day highlights, we've got a guy called Jer Thorpe, who's a data artist in residence at the New York Times. So basically, he takes data and makes them into beautiful graphs that are a lot more understandable by everybody. That's what data visualization is about. There's a company called Emotive that have, I can't pronounce it very well, but they have created a technology that allows you to control your computer without a mouse. Without a mouse, because you control it with your brain. So let's have a look at that. Eh? And there's also big players in there. So there's one of the senior executives of Cisco who's coming to talk. Cisco is one of the leading company in terms of technology that makes the internet work. So if you want to see what's happening in the future of internet, he's the one to listen to. And just to end the day on a lighter note, there's Tom Scott, who will finish Thursday. He's a kind of geek comedian, so he will end the show in his usual crazy fashion. Apparently, he also runs the British part of International Talk Like a Pirate Day. So hey, it's not only technology. So anyway, the live cast will be next Wednesday and Thursday, the 25th and the 26th of May, in the Annex. And tickets are £25 full price and £20 concession for a day. Or if you want to come and listen to all the speakers, it's £35 for a 2-day pass, £30 for concession. There you go.
Thanks, Isabel. Okay, that's all we've got time for, so you can check all the times and whatever's happening on our website, www.cornerhouse.org. See you next week. Remember, I know we're talking about horror films, but don't have nightmares. Do sleep well.
You've been listening to the Corner House podcast.